You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome this week to Bookworm. My guest is John Sayles, author most recently of Los Gusanos, but author as well of two previous novels, The Pride of the Bimbos and Union Dues, a book of short stories called The Anarchist Convention, and many films, including Matawan, Eight Men Out, Brother from Another Planet. This one is published by HarperCollins, just to get that in. This is a book which gave me a great deal of pleasure because a good deal of it is includes dialogue in untranslated Spanish, and I guess I begin by asking about multiculturalism.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to get across in Los Gusanos is that you had an exile community who, the book is set in 1981, many of the people came in 1960 or 61. In those 20 years, there has been a feeling of neither here nor there. Are we going back? Are we staying here? Are we staying here but keeping our culture intact, which might even be possible if enough of us band together here in Miami and kind of, you know, grow a shell around ourselves? And I think it got to the point where an awful lot of Cubans in America, and you could probably say this of Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans and other people who've come here who are Hispanic, end up not only speaking half English and half Spanish, sometimes in the same sentence, but thinking at it as well. And what is that final bit of assimilation when you start actually thinking in the other language?
You've been interested in the languages of groups and subcultures. I guess the first story I read of yours was in The Atlantic. It was the trucker's story.
I-80 Nebraska.
Yeah. They're talking on the radio to one another in, what is it, CD speak?
CB.
CB, yeah. Right. And eventually, out of this argot comes a whole metaphysical, cosmic rap that is about the creation of the universe, done late at night over too much coffee, over the various arterials of the country, a kind of beautiful idea. This, too, a book of private intercommunication. Los Gusanos are the worms, the people who fled the Fidel's Cuba and live in perpetual revolution, yearning for a return to the island. What was the, did you spend much time around Florida? What was the research for the book?
Yeah, when I grew up, my grandparents lived in the Miami area, so I've been coming down there since the mid-50s. Had an idea of what the city was and the rhythm of it and the feel of it in the 50s before the exodus of Cubans. Was there just before and just after the first wave of people came. Just before and just after the Bay of Pigs invasion, and then every year or two was going down until I decided to write the book in 78, and then I came down much more specifically to do research. I was able to go down in 1981 during the Freedom Flotilla in Mariel and interview people for a magazine. My Spanish had gotten good enough then so that I could kind of understand what people were saying if I asked them to talk slowly. And so it's been a long, long dance with this book.
It bears the mark of years of composition. Was it a long one?
Yeah, I started it probably about 13 years ago. Wrote an outline and maybe the first 80 pages or so. Then got involved in making movies. And in those years of making movies, I never felt like, well, I have enough time to really sit down and concentrate on this book. What I did have enough time on is when I had weeks off, I would go to Miami, I would go back into research, and was constantly, no matter what I was doing, working on my Spanish. Once your antenna are out for a subject, it seems like every other thing is about it. And so you end up collecting a world that you can immerse yourself in.
You once infuriated me by saying that you believed a writer had to be able to, if necessary, and you could, write in bus stations, in hotel mm-hmm. rooms, in the midst of crowds. Do you still feel that way?
Oh, yeah. I've written in front of the TV recently with the mute button on. But, yeah, I think that for me anyway, and I've met some other writers who absolutely need their pristine, you know, 7 to 10 in the morning schedule and no distractions and those kind of things. What I find is that once I get into the rhythm of what I'm writing, once I get my feet wet into that, almost everything else disappears. It's one of the reasons I've been able to work on 2 or 3 screenplays about very different things simultaneously and maybe a short story.
I believe you, because years and years ago when I first moved here, I was working at a script typing house as a proofreader, and a script kept coming in from you. It was, of all things, a samurai script. Mm-hmm. And I think every day for a week we got completely different versions of it, mm-hmm. and I imagine this person sweating in a hotel room mm-hmm. Writing around 70 or 80 pages a day.
Yeah, that was one of those situations where it was a movie that eventually was called The Challenge, and there was a Directors Guild strike looming, and so they needed the green light over the weekend. So I had basically 3 days to write this thing, and then once they got the green light, they said, okay, start on the second draft. And as they'd cast actors, they'd say, oh, give all the English lines to Saito because, you know, Nakamura, who we just cast, doesn't really speak any English.
This kind of rough and ready aesthetic I identify with Ben Hecht a lot. Do you feel any kind of affiliation with those early Hollywood writers who came in like gangbusters?
I think to a certain extent my first several screenplays, which were rewrites, which were movies where I often picked them specifically because these people have a shooting date and it's not too far in the future. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be the last writer on this. Mm-hmm. You know, so whatever stamp I put on the script is going to stay on it, and I'm not going to be one in a series, and by the time the movie comes out, it's not going to have anything to do with me. And I think in the days that when they first came out of playwriting to Hollywood, there wasn't that that habit of taking years and years to develop something. It was, oh, we're excited and we've got this actor scheduled for this time. You guys come in and do a little dialogue polish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But also I think, you know, guys like Hecht used to like to use their newspaper days and they time spent around emergency clinics. I think of those writers as being writers also of male groups, mm-hmm. the journalists in His Girl Friday. Mm-hmm. And I think of your writing very much that way, too, professionals who gather in tightly knit groups, whether they're anarchists or unionists mm-hmm. or whoever they might be, baseball players, mm-hmm. A kind of interest in the ongoing lope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like an ongoing conversation, and you're either in the conversation or you're not in the conversation. One of the more recent movies I can see that had some of that was Diner, is that there's always a conversation at the diner, and you can miss 6 months and come into the diner and people say hi and you sit down and then you're back into it. You know, it's always like the non-ending poker game. There was the town Thurmond where we shot Mate One had a poker game that lasted for 18 years, you know, and it just never stopped because there were coal brokers and people coming in at every hours. And, you know, the cards were changed in the middle of the game, but the game never stopped for 18 years.
You, along with, I guess, Joyce Carol Oates, are two of the, I think, very few working-class novelists or writers who write consistently about the working mm-hmm. class of America. Who are the others? Are there people
on
the front?
There are other people. I think that, you know, there were more in the 30s and 40s. You know, certainly some of the people that I learned from were like Nelson Algren and James T. Farrell and people like that. There are other people. I don't read enough to have a bunch of them on my tongue, but I certainly run into those. You know, there's a guy named Theodore Wiesner who wrote
a
really nice
The Car Thief,
which is a great
book,
and hasn't written that much since. But,
a couple of books, and now he's writing thrillers, which always worries me.
But you know, every once in a while, I'll cut into somebody who's really doing good work in that area.
I'm always curious to see, you know, like, what am I missing, you know, while I'm being thrown only the people who are being sent around on their tours. You know, I want to be sure that nothing is of the car thief's quality.
There's a book called Mohawk. Do you know who wrote Mohawk?
Terrific. Richard Russo, is it?
Yeah, I think his name is Russo, and he's written a couple others.
Very good, yeah.
He's in that world.
Do you regard yourself as a tough guy writer?
Not really. I think that there are so many different voices in the things that I do that each chapter has its own voice. There are two or three tough guy voices in this particular, you know, book because of the character who is seeing the world in that particular chapter. But I don't think that that's the overall bent of what I'm doing. As a matter of fact, I try to avoid having my own personal style. And if I do have a personal style, it's to get into the style and rhythm of many different characters.
You are politically leftist, more or less, and you know, I have friends who, you know, live for your movies because they find, you know, it's sort of going to the movies now is like looking into the mirror and not seeing your face again and again and again. But I found when reading Los Gusanos, a question that came up for me, the level, and it's not invented by you, of sexual terrorism in the book and the machismo of the Cuban community is a very strong element. Sex and torture run through this book. And it seemed to me that while I know you have made feminist movies, there's a certain level of pleasure in the writing of these explosive scenes. And I wanted to ask you about that. Does that, like, conflict you morally in some way?
I think that, you know, two things. One is that as I got into the story and started reading the history and reading the history of the days before Batista's fall, the history of the days of Machado, the history of what Havana was, in some senses, what it really was and what it was in many people's minds to North America, which it kind of got to be, you know, the Tijuana of the Caribbean. It was where North Americans went to do the things that they would never do back home, you know, and it was considered, oh, you know, these people don't mind. In fact, you know, they're having a great time down there, you know, kind of shining our shoes and, you know, taking care of our sexual needs. There is a brutality always associated with it that was unavoidable. And that sword, that two-edged sword of, yes, the money is coming in, but look what we're having to do with it, was the fuel for an awful lot of the anger of Cubans against Batista, against North Americans. And so that you have a character like Blas de la Pena, who's somebody who was very anti-Batista, but he's no big buddy of the Yankees either. Because one of the things that always galled him was how Batista just kind of, you know, figuratively opened the legs of the country for these North Americans as long as they paid well. That brutality I found unavoidable, and I felt like that the second part of that had to be getting into the minds of the people who do that brutality. So certainly there is pleasure in some of the people who are dishing it out. And I think that's an important part of it, is that you know, that we see, okay, who's just doing this because they're lost in the flood, and who's doing this because they become a person whereby, you know, this is part of who they are, and this is part of how they say, I am, I have power in the world.
It's just that, and while I'm aware that, you know, representing something is not the same as enacting it, and it's a thing that must be remembered, I've come to notice recently in reading Joan Didion's book about Miami, in reading this and comparing it, say, to the writing of Cubano writers like Cabrera Infantes and his book Tres Tristes Tigres, Three Trapped Tigers, and the great Cuban homosexual writer Lezama Limas in his book Paradiso, that the Americans still have a way of turning the scene in Havana into a melodramatic, gory night mm-hmm. world, and that the Cuban writers tend to be a lot more ironically at ease with its hysteria. Mm-hmm. It seems to be the North American tendency mm-hmm. to up the sexual ante mm-hmm. and lay the pressure on.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, in the research for this book, I read probably at least a half dozen Cuban short stories that were about the main male character's first visit to the brothel. And it's often a very pleasant story. And so I think that there was a day-to-day about that for Cubans of a certain class in a certain time. In this particular novel, the main thing that's happening in the chapter that's set in that world is that Batista's army is falling apart. The world is coming down around the ears of a guy who is a secret policeman and torturer first, and, kind of the bagman for the red light district second. So that adds that extra, I think, violent edge to something that was just kind of, everyday business as usual.
I'm talking to John Sayles, the author of Los Gusanos, published by HarperCollins. This book is about a female martyr and would-be saint. Mm-hmm. There is a tendency on the part of bad guy American writers to be interested in saints. Mark Twain wrote an entire book about the life of Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. I wondered what led you to a figure like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised Catholic, for one thing, and certainly saints were often the role models that we were taught in religious instruction. And when you're a kid, you accept them at face value. You don't think too deeply into who they might have been. They're like your superheroes. The St. Joan or St. Stephen or whoever just seem like these, people like Batman, except they get killed and Batman never does. And so in some ways, the kind of media superheroes, when you're a kid and you don't want to know about vulnerability and dying and things like that, are much more attractive. As I got older, I started to feel and think about, well, what must have these people really been like? And then as you read the history again a little bit older, you start to realize, even in their own time, they were considered a pain. These are inconvenient people who make other people uncomfortable. Yes, they do become a phenomenon, draw a lot of faith toward them, inspire a lot of people, but usually the reason they're getting crucified or whatever they're getting is that they've made a lot of trouble and made a lot of people uncomfortable. In the case of St. Joan, she was finally executed not for being a patriot, but for being a heretic by people of her own religion. And I got interested in that idea of what must go on in the mind of a saint. Once you're on that road, what must you think the world is and what must you think you yourself is?
There is a good deal of the psychopathology of sainthood in this book mm-hmm. and the repression. Did you do any reading in that area?
Not so much psychological writing, but kind of imaginative writing of reading the lives of different saints and mm-hmm. saying, okay, what was the situation in this country? Was this a poor person? Was this a rich person? Was there any other way for that person to have any power in the world besides becoming a saint? Mm-hmm. Was there a people to be led? Certainly you're talking before about being left wing or right wing. The spectrum in this book for me is not between left and right wing. That's not what's important, although that's very important to the characters. The spectrum I was interested in is the spectrum between believers and cynics.
Mm-hmm.
And that Marta de la Peña, the kind of protagonist of the book, is the true believer, the true simple believer who wants to relight the flame of counter-revolution. Then on the far, far, far side are El Halcón, who's the kind of torturer for Batista, and Walt, who's a very low-level CIA stringer, who have both become extremely cynical, are really in it for the game, to become operational, to have an expense account. And they play with people's lives. And neither of them really believes in anything at the end of it. They think that, democracy, communism, all these things are just kind of words, and that finally there's only power, and that the cynical people have the power, partly because of their worldview, and how much more information they're able to take in to control the believers, to point those believers in directions. And you can see that in armies, you can see that in governments. And then the rest of the characters kind of fit in that spectrum as closer to believer or closer to cynic.
The book even structurally has a kind of counterpoint between the pragmatic and the ideal. Mm-hmm. I think in particular of the scene in the supermarket where an ex-priest, now supermarket manager, mm-hmm. is telling the story to Marta mm-hmm. of sainthood as the checkout counter people yell up at him, "How much is tuna?"
You know, right.
It's sort of a version of Flaubert's famous agricultural fair in Madame Bovary.
Mm-hmm.
But there, here the play between the world of things as they mm-hmm. are and the world of the spirit is very highly charged.
And even when he goes back into a church, now that he's, you know, lost his collar and somewhat lost his faith, all he can remember when he sees the statue is taking it out of the box and how much the candles cost and what the catalog number was for reordering it, all the secular details of running this operation, this church.
The book also is punctuated by songs, mm-hmm. Spanish songs, and there's a lot of approximations of different kinds of nightlife, whether it's the salsa band of 1981 Miami or the 1960s Habana. I wondered about the background music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was talking with somebody last night about Mambo King sings songs of love.
The Huelos, yeah.
Yeah, and I felt like they should have included a cassette with the book. And apparently, as part of the promotion in Britain, they actually did gather some of those songs. One of the things that I try to do is write rhythmically and find the right rhythm for a character. So in this book, there's a character named Dewey, who's a 15-year-old kid who wants to be G.I. Joe, whose head is in Soldier of Fortune magazine. And his rhythm is this kind of military rhythm of 0700 hours, take shower. You know, he wants life to be simple and ordered and those kind of things. Another character, Luce, maybe somebody who you get two commas per page. Mm-hmm. Her rhythm can be very, very flowing when she's out on the town.
And she has Rethke quoted at her, am I right?
Yes, yes. and thinks it's just some old guy in a nursing home, being cute. But music, I think, is very important to Cuba. And once again, there is a spectrum of music. There is the music of different decades, and there is the music of the spectrum from African to Gallego. And Afro-Cuban music has been very important in the development of American jazz, American rock and roll, and it was really the meeting of these, kind of the gypsies and the, flamencos of Spain and the trovadores with African rhythms. That's where it met in Cuba.
One of your movies is located at that cusp where a woman is making a decision about her sexuality, mm-hmm. The decision to love another woman or not. And some of the criticism of that film was, how could you be the spokesman for mm-hmm. this woman? What was the nature of the dialectic between mm-hmm. you as the writer-director and her life? Now you've taken on something, in a way, much more controversial, being mm-hmm. the spokesman for an entirely other culture. How do you mm-hmm. feel about that as a writer?
Well, I think automatically writing anything that's not your autobiography is pretentious. You're pretending to be able to share something about other people's lives that you've observed, that you've been told. You're passing something on that you think that you've maybe connected a few dots for people, or else you're collecting the information and you let them connect the dots. But that's automatically pretentious, and if you're afraid of that, you shouldn't be a writer. You should just write about yourself. You should become Proust, and just go back into your own memory. What I try to do is not so much tell my story through other people, but absorb enough of other people's stories to try to give them voice. And that's you know, you do it better or worse, but that's really a lot of what I try to do, is I try to, you know, look into, listen, you know, listening is the most important part of my job, and it may be listening to what people say on a page in some cases, or what they say out loud, or watching and listening to what their body language in a certain situation is. But then I really try to get into that voice. It's one of the reasons why, having been an actor before I was a writer, continuing to act now and then, now that I'm making movies, is important to me as a writer. When you're an actor, you know, I've had the opportunity a couple times to play different roles in the same play at different times. So I was in Of Mice and Men a few times playing different roles. You're walking into the same bunkhouse. It's the same closed world of the lines of that play. But when you walk in as the retarded guy, you know, who wants something soft to pet, you see a totally different bunkhouse than you walk in as the old man who's worried about losing his job and having nowhere to go and becoming a bindle stiff. You have different eyes. And that's what I really try to do, is get into those eyes of those other people, see their worldview. And a lot of that, you know, 80% of the job to me is listening.
What happens next?
What happens next? In fiction, I hope to, in the next couple years, complete enough short stories to have another short story collection out. I have a few vague ideas for novels, which are going to have to percolate for a while. I tend to write very fast, but as I said, 80% of the job is listening. And so one of the reasons I tend to write fast is, you know, I've written screenplays that I've made into movies where the first draft was 1 week, but it was in my head for a year and a half or 2 years. And once it's in there, it starts collecting ideas. And I don't necessarily even write things down. I figure the things that are good will stay in there, you know, and the things that are just kind of dumb ideas, you know, I've been lucky enough a couple times to find something that I thought I lost, you know, start a short story, lose the pages, and then sit down and say, oh, I have to reconstruct this. And it may be a week later because I got busy with something else, and then find the second thing and compare it to the first. And it's amazing how close they are. And it's not because I remembered, it's because what struck me about what was important to that story, you know, was still there, without having, you know, written notes down. So I don't worry when I work on a computer now that it's going to, you know, if it eats 10 pages, you know, if they were any good, I'll get them back because they're in my memory somewhere.
I've been talking to John Sayles, the author most recently of Los Gusanos, a novel published by HarperCollins. Thank you for being with me here today.
Thanks, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books. Too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse of time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.